Hi, friends. Today on the Successful-ish podcast, we're talking to Trina Stutzman about people-pleasing, answering questions like, what is people-pleasing? How do we know if we're a people-pleaser? Why do nice guys finish last? Are nice people actually unsafe people? And how can I accommodate others without stiffing on the accommodation for myself? As always, we try to keep our conversations uninterrupted because we like it that way. If you would like to help keep it that way, you can support our podcast by visiting anchor.fm/successfulish/support.
Another day, another task, think fast with a whole nother mission complete.
Successful-ish.
Pick up the weight, press on, and act on the visions I see.
I'm successful-ish.
Sit back and bask in the glory of all the goals I achieve.
Successful-ish.
Lose a stack, get it back, reinvest, hope with, then I roll up my sleeve.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Successful-ish. I'm Sarah Michelle, and I'm so excited to talk to a friend of mine today, Trina Stutzman. Trina is a holistic health coach and a midwife of the soul. With over 25 years of personal and professional experience in health and coaching, Trina wants every woman to live and give freely. Trina is a sought-after coach, speaker, and thought leader in the spiritual growth space. She holds credentials through Stephen Ministry International and International Coaching Federation, and holds a certificate in family business advising from the Family Firm Institute, and is a trained Reiki master. Trina combines her passions to help clients take inventory of all the roles they're playing and to get to the root of who they actually are. And together they identify where the source of unhappiness and stress is coming from, recognize their choices, implement a plan to show up differently, and to learn how to live a life that they love. When she's not nurturing others, she can be found living the life she loves with her four children in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I will add to that list, Trina's also a published author, just published her first book. It's fantastic. Highly recommend it. 12 Steps to Overcoming People Pleasing. And I first met Trina through another client of mine. I've long collaborated with a branding agency based out of Pennsylvania, and they referred me to Trina and we got to work together. So it's fun reading her bio because I know some of those phrases we collaborated on and noodled with and played with and came up together. And it's just so fun to see it all come together. So I am so excited to talk about people pleasing, which has been a big theme. It's the theme of the book that was just written. And I love that when we talked the first time and really started weeding through the language of the brand, some of the language was being a midwife of the soul. And I love that because we both had very similar backgrounds, sort of growing up in a very legalistic kind of conservative religion. And there's a lot of talk in that about being, quote, reborn. And I think to quite literally discover that, but in a different context and sort of be reborn into this place of freedom and confidence and being able to play is just a really powerful thing. And so I am excited to talk today because Trina has just such beautiful visuals and stories and ways of being able to talk about that and to talk about how we can successfully please ourselves more than we please other people. So Trina, thank you so much for hanging out today.
You are so welcome. And yes, thank you for that introduction. And you have been a pleasure to work with. And I'm so excited for this conversation because it has been kind of a culmination of a lot of our work together, kind of culminating in this moment. And I appreciate being on this podcast and you introducing me to your community. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually, Trina and I have spent a lot of time together recently. We are doing a year-long book club, which I got to say, when I first started, I thought, I don't know, a year is a lot. Like, do I really want to hang out with people for a year? Do I really want to read a book for a year? But I think that there is something really cool about sticking it out for a longer duration of time. I don't know what your experience has been, but I feel like we're such a microwave generation. Everything is so quick and in and out. And I think even when it comes to people pleasing and living our lives, I feel like we've become really good at just very quickly adapting to every setting we're thrown into. And I know that's at least been my experience of, okay, I have to be what this company wants. I have to be what this client wants. I have to be what this romantic partner wants. I have to be what this parent wants. And I think that there's something about the longevity of being with a group of people where you can't keep up the pretenses. You really have to drop that and just be yourself and learn to be comfortable. And I think that especially with our digital generation, sometimes it's uncomfortable to actually have conversations and to have that accountability of knowing that it's not just going to be a quick 1 month where you can impress someone with who you are. If you're spending years with someone, eventually they're going to see the bad parts too. And that's a part of being human. I don't know what is your experience with that?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's value in the longevity of a group because we're so prone to always wanting to look good, you know, where this social media is avoiding looking bad. And when you're in a part of a group where you're, you know, even last month, it was like, you know, you all held me accountable to what I said I was going to do. And they're like, well, why not? Why can't you do that? You know, and it's like, that's what comes with, you know, deepening relationships with people. We can't get away with looking good. You know, we can't avoid that looking, and I don't like to use those words bad and good, but there's a strong desire to have people's approval. And it even goes into groups like this where we're digging a little deeper.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a different way of even thinking about looking good, because I think that, like you said, we sometimes polarize that good and bad. And I think that looking good is just being human. It's all a mixed bag. I think it's
or looking bad is just being human, right?
Yeah, it's just being human. It's just, all balances out. So before we jump into your story and digging into people pleasing, what is something that you have failed at this week?
What I failed at is more of a personal standard that I hold myself to. And that is just, you know, getting outside and moving. I pride myself. I came up with this 30-day activity for January where I was spending time outside. And I thought that I had developed this habit and I thought it was I got so much energy from it. And so just to being aware that as I've gotten with the launch on this weekend, and I just didn't take care of myself as well as I wanted to in the last week. So again, it's just something that I hold myself to, but something that I don't feel great about.
Yeah. It's amazing how quickly we can lose habits. It feels like it takes forever to develop them. And then, I mean, they're gone in a second. It's the same way I feel about working out. Like it takes forever to get the muscles. But then if I take a couple days off of the gym or working out, you know, the next time I go in, I'm dying 5 minutes in.
The good thing is we can jump back in at any time, you know, but that was just one of them this week that I was like, I wanted to maintain that energy, that high energy that I had, but I had other things that were giving me energy too. So yeah.
Awesome. Well, tell us a little bit about your successful story, sort of your background, where you came from, and how you got into this work that you do now.
Yeah, as you mentioned in the bio, I've been coaching in some form of another for over 25 years. I started my professional career as a health and physical education teacher, which is why I kind of pride myself in kind of being physically active. And so it hurts when I don't do that because it is a passion of mine. But yeah, then I started having children and have 4 children. And I kind of say that they're my most important coaching clients, so to speak. If I can do well with them, I feel like that's the success story for me. But in the midst of all that, I had developed thyroid cancer. And when my third child was born, and that was really a starting point. You asked, you know, thinking about how long I have written this book, I have really been writing it for over 20 years. That was kind of, you know, I was a healthy 30-year-old and developed thyroid cancer. And people were like, what? You're so healthy. And that was my wake up call when I realized that cancer, I couldn't say the C word for a while, but I took it to mean change. And that's really when I started to live more my values, my values of health, spirituality, and truth. And so it's been over those 30 years. My former spouse was a pastor of a large congregation. I kind of had that midlife unraveling in there that really started to use my voice. I wanted to get in touch with why I had this kind of dis-ease in my throat and really started to looking at ways that I wasn't expressing myself and wasn't being true to myself. And it really became part of kind of this awakening, you know, waking up to what was really important and valuable to me. And so this book that I just published is really a culmination of a lot of years. The first step, Let That Should Go, was part of my first journeying of letting go of what I thought others thought I needed to do and be. And as you mentioned, growing up in a legalistic, strict religious community, I was part of the Mennonites. If you've ever heard of the Amish are on one end, and the liberal Mennonites church that I attend is on the other end. So there's this continuum, and there was a lot of shoulds. And it was from that where I started looking at all the shoulds in my life and started to think about choices that I could make, because should really isn't a free word, right? We don't really aren't freely living with that word should. There's some kind of guilt or expectation or must or ought that comes with that should. And so that's really been my successful-ish journey, has been just really getting clear about what is important to me and what is true and right for me, which can kind of go against some of that shoulding that we do on ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. For you, if you think back, what is your earliest memory of people pleasing, or when do you think that started for you? Where do you think that's something that we are naturally born with? Do you think that it's an external thing? Like, where did that start for you? What did that look like?
Yeah, I feel like it was an external thing. You know, growing up in a religious community, when there's not a lot of communication, there's a lot of assumptions that happen. So we assume that we should do this or I must do that. My earliest memory was back in second grade. I had won a coloring contest, and coloring the lines kind of traumatized me, actually. I had just been at a new school and I had been given this prize, and it was an ice cream sandwich. Everybody should love ice cream sandwiches, should like ice cream sandwiches, but I didn't. And what I wish I would have known back then was that I was allowed to talk back. You know, one of the thoughts that I have is, you know, what do I wish I would have known, or somebody would have told me? I wish somebody would have told me that I could have talked back, because I wasn't allowed in my religious home to talk back. And I don't fault my father for doing that. That was probably what he was taught, not to talk back. But I didn't have a voice. I couldn't say in that moment that, as my daughter says, I taught her the perfect letdown statement. And that is, thank you for this prize. I don't like ice cream sandwiches, but thank you. Can I share it with someone? You know, I wasn't given the voice to be able to believe that I had choice about what I was given. It was just, I couldn't even say no, thank you. And so, you know, this book is really about finding my voice and being unapologetic about using my voice.
Yeah, I think that I can relate to that. And I think what is a little bit heartbreaking to me is that as an adult, I would agree that it's so important to learn how to use your voice and to be able to use it. But when you are a kid, or when you're in certain circumstances, you really can't. Because I had the very similar experience where I could not use my voice. It was told that I was wrong or that I was being disrespectful. And so I think that you grow up learning that if you use your voice, it's bad, or it's sinful, or it's punishable. And I think that that can be a really difficult thing to unlearn. What was that process like for you to unlearn that and to kind of switch gears and realize as an adult that you didn't have to have the same fear and constraints that you did previously?
Yeah, I think it's really important that, again, not everybody deserves our truth, right? As we get older, we don't need to be, you know, tell the truth with everyone and just be brutally honest. I guess I started by who were the safe people in my life. I had a friend that came along into my life around the time that I had cancer. Actually, I call her my 9/11 friend, because I was getting cancer treatment during 9/11 and was afraid to go into the city, into Philadelphia. And she's like, I'll go with you. And we became friends, but she was a safe person to start to hear who I was. She asked great questions and she was interested in hearing, you know, don't talk back means I don't care what you think. I don't want to know what you think and feel. And there was no dialogue. And so here I had a person in my life who was safe with to open up, you know, because I was keeping a lot of secrets about who I was. And I wasn't being honest. I mean, I think the biggest aha moment was when somebody called me a liar. People pleasers are liars. And I was like, what? Me, a liar? But yeah, not being truthful, not being honest about, you know, what I think and feel. But that, like you said, there's such ingrained patterns that we need to start to, you know, that whole I shouldn't give my opinion, or I could give my opinion. And then choosing, what am I going to choose? And so I always say kind of making a different choice with safe people. Start to make a different choice with safe people and notice, start to really notice when you aren't being as honest, when you're saying it's okay, when it's really not okay, or when you're saying yes, when you mean no. Yeah, those are what I would say to start to untangle that. A different choice with safe people, you know, who were, you know, and I felt fortunate to have that kind of friend come on into my life at that time.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting challenge because I feel like there's people on different ends of the spectrum where it's not just undoing the patterns of people pleasing. That's a challenge in and of itself, but also recognizing if you might not be in a safe context to do so, and if so, how to create a safe context. And that's a lot to figure out at the same time, because I think that for many of us, we sort of figure out the rules of life within the constraints of what's around us, within the constraints of our culture. And so I think that I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. It almost feels like we might not even know what free thinking or not people pleasing looks like, because we can only see it within the world that we're in.
Yes.
And, you know, for me, like growing up in a religious home, having a religious and very controlling husband, I would have been able to read your book and to think about ways to not be a people pleaser, but it would have all been squished within the lines of what I was allowed within my circumstance.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about how to maybe kind of go outside the lines and maybe even recognize what those constraints may be and how you were able to sort of see that even in your marriage and realize, you know what, I'm going on this journey of learning to be myself, but I'm also realizing that there's a ceiling where I'm at. And so this person does not allow me to be myself. Therefore, I need to separate from this person. What was that experience like for you? How did you navigate that?
Well, I think, you know, in meeting this friend, I had gone out on a limb and went to a new group. I was actually at another church, and it was a part of a pastor's wife's group at the time where I met this friend. And then a couple years later, I went to another group that was outside of that confines of my normal group of people, which I guess I encourage people to get used to being uncomfortable, get comfortable being uncomfortable. Because if you keep, you know, this book won't mean much if you're still in the same confines. And so I do say kind of read my book, but there's a warning, like you're going to step on some toes. It's going to be a new dance if you're trying to do it with the same people. You know, maybe the dance can be started with some new friends. You know, that was really helpful for me as I, you know, could show up in a new group, trying on and trying out different ways of being that wouldn't have worked in the old setting, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think that asking questions and listening is a big part of education. I think education is a big part of having that freedom and being yourself, and also a big red flag that you're not with a safe person if someone does not want you to be educated, if they try to control the narrative, if they don't allow you to ask questions, or if they try to keep you within the cloister or keep you within a certain context. I think that a safe person is going to want you to be your fullest self. And there's no fear in exploring other cultures, other ways of doing things, asking people.
Yes.
So I think that people pleasing means a lot of different things to different people. How do you define people pleasing?
The best definition that I like is someone who is bargaining for love. If I keep you happy, then you will love me. If I take care of you, then you will love me. So it can be manipulative. You're giving to get, so to speak.
Yeah. I think that's a really powerful definition. And it does have a lot to do, I think, with being in safe spaces with safe people and learning how to be in a position where you can fully be yourself and feel safe doing that. And I think that it's one of those things. I don't know any people. I know there are, but I have not heard anyone say out loud consciously, I'm not safe being myself. I don't know that that's something that is out loud articulated, but I think that if we look at what that really means and we really pay attention to any time that we sort of hold our breath when we have a different opinion, or anytime our shoulders kind of hunch up when we are around a certain person, I think that there's little tiny ways that our bodies maybe know things that we haven't quite listened to. Mm-hmm. And I am curious for you when it was that you recognized that you were a people pleaser, and was it something that your body knew before you did? Was it a certain event? Was it a slow process? Like, what was that discovery like for you?
Yeah, I think it's just been a really slow process. And I kind of point back to my cancer diagnosis, but it's obvious it's been a real journey. And one of the things that I started to notice that in my family of origin is that I kind of describe feelings as a keys on a piano. And we played a lot in the middle of the keyboard. If I went too high and was too excited, you know, that wasn't received well. And if I went too low, they didn't know what to do with that either. So it was like this just kind of flatlined, be flatlined. And I think I started recognizing that I felt unsafe with people who weren't okay with either the highs or the lows. You know, a friend would say, well, just test out, you know, sharing something happy with people. And because at some point I did share something good with somebody in my close circle and it didn't feel safe. And so I just kind of stayed in the middle of the road, just trying to please them, telling them what they wanted to hear, so that they wouldn't be uncomfortable, either high or low. Does that make sense? And so I just started to, again, showing up and being, you know, obviously when I separated from my former husband the first time in 2006 was a huge unraveling. And that had been a process for over 6 years from the time that I had cancer, that I started to just move the line of what I was able to tolerate. You know, and that was when I started to, you know, feel more of the low notes and feel more of the high notes. And again, it did come through my body. You're right. There was some things that just you didn't feel safe with. And for me, I feel it in my shoulders. Feeling that weight of feeling responsible for everybody's reactions and their responses to what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful thing that you just said about changing the line of what you're willing to tolerate. And I think that was one thing for me. I don't remember where it came from. I feel like it was a friend that encouraged me to really think about whenever someone is treating you a certain way or talking to you a certain way, would you ever do that to someone else? Because I think often, especially as women, we give a lot of free passes. We make excuses for people of, well, they had a bad day. Well, you know, they didn't have the greatest parents. Well, no one ever taught them how to do that. And it wasn't until someone else pointed out to me, they were like, you know, Sarah, if I recall, no one taught you that either.
Yeah.
Like, right. You didn't have the greatest upbringing either. Like, you are allowed to have bad days too. And I started thinking about it from that context and thought, you know what, even on my worst day, I've never responded like that. Even on my worst day, I've never reacted like that. And I think changing that tolerance and looking for reciprocity was really life-changing for me, and realizing, you know what, I am going to be a little more honest about the frequency I want to live at. Mm-hmm. And anyone who doesn't want to operate at this level, you know, no hard feelings, but you can't you can't play in my circle. You got to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Do you think that everyone is a people pleaser to some degree, or do you think some aren't?
I think you mentioned, you know, the continuum. I definitely feel like there's a continuum of people pleasing. You know, some people have a higher need for approval and to get that love, and others I think have really worked at boundaries and have a strong sense of self. But I think there's definitely, you know, cultural and religious norms and that have formed our personalities around this idea of getting approval, you know, looking good in the eyes of God and the eyes of our family, eyes of others, and really not having that approval, our own approval.
Right.
What if I'm okay with who I am?
So something that I want to talk a little bit about, and this is a little muddled, so I'm going to do my best to work my way through it. But I know for me, when it came to unraveling people pleasing, I really struggled with feeling confident that I had an accurate view of my reality. I think that for many people who struggle with people pleasing, it's because they had some kind of toxic or abusive relationship in their life. And that often goes with narcissism, which is a very inflated view of self. And that can make you have almost like a deflated view of self because you don't want to be that person that thinks that they're awesome, but is actually hurting people. And I'm curious because I think a lot of setting yourself free from people pleasing is being really confident. And like you said, being comfortable playing on any key. However, I think I was watching Taylor Tomlinson. She's a very funny comedian. And she just did a new Netflix special on mental health. And she made this reference about how she didn't know that she had bipolar. And for a long time, she was just aggressively playing on all ends of the piano, so to speak. And it was not until she realized that she had bipolar that she realized, oh, maybe I need to rein it in a little bit. And she makes this really funny analogy about how it's kind of like you want to go swimming, but you don't have the ability to swim. And so you just have to, you know, deal with your emotions or your bipolar or whatever that might be and put your arm floaties on, and then you're good. You can go to any pool you want. But if you know that you can't swim, you should not dive into the deep end and make your lack of swimming a problem for other people. And it was a funny way of putting it, but I'm sort of curious on your perspective of how we gauge that, because I do think there's a balance between, absolutely, you should be your fullest self. You should be playing on every key. You should be who you are. However, sometimes some of us need to kind of put that in check. So, and there's a lot of gaslighting, especially when you grow up in a people-pleasing or religious background where you're taught to not trust yourself and to not listen to yourself and to discount your life experience. So with all of that in mind, how do we get to a place of being able to feel confident that we are really seeing clearly and that we are safe being our full selves?
Yeah, I guess I should just clarify. I don't believe that you should play all the keys of the piano with everybody. You know, I definitely feel like not everybody deserves that. And just because you've known them your whole life, they still don't deserve that. Get your question right. How do we have a clear view of ourselves and what we're
How do we get to a place where we can comfortably and confidently be our fullest selves, but also not use that as an excuse to then be an unsafe person to other people? Because sometimes it goes a little too far on the extreme where we're like, well, I'm not going to please anyone. I'm going to do what I want and screw you if you disagree. Yeah. And I don't think that's healthy either.
Well, my daughter, who's going to be 22 this week, says, Mom, you know, like, I feel like our generation needs to go the other way. Well, we need to people please a little bit more. I was like, I guess I did my job well then, you know, like I feel like I gave you a voice and gave you freedom, but yeah, I think it's really, you know, we talk about even in the workplace, how much do we people please and how much does that contribute to our success? I guess I see caring so much about what other people think, as long as we do that, we're kind of prisoners. We're really not able to uncover who we really are. And as people pleasers, we're walking around just you know, another version of somebody else. And so really, I think, you know, the reality of who we are, I think, you know, we find out who we don't want to be. So maybe you are all the way out there. And like she said, she had to kind of come back, or somebody helped her come back. That's the value, I think, in groups that we've created. And what I hope to create with my book is that, you know, we need places where we can test these things and we can try on and learn from them and reflection. That's why there's some reflection questions in my book, because it's not just a quick fix. This isn't a overnight thing. It is really a process where we, you know, have to learn a new dance, and it is awkward. The new dance is awkward and it's clumsy, and you're going to step on people's toes, and it's not going to go well all the time.
Right. Well, and I think what you touched on earlier too, just that aspect of fear, I think knowing what our motivation or our source is makes a really big difference. There's a difference between me accommodating, whether it's a romantic partner or a boss or whoever, and trying to please them because I'm afraid of them. I'm afraid of what they'll do if I don't, versus me accommodating them because I want to be a nice person. And I think that that's really important, to sort of know our own boundaries. And I find a lot of time with unsafe people, particularly, they're not aware of their boundaries. They can sometimes be very people-pleasing and very accommodating, but then they end up being resentful. And it's almost like they're doing a bunch of favors, and in their mind, that's all going into a bank account that entitles them to make a withdrawal anytime they want. And I've run into that before, where it just comes out in weird ways, and people will be like, well, what about that thing I did for you in 1992? And I'm like, well, I was unaware of the terms of payment I would have declined.
Yes, exactly. It's really checking your motives. You know, are you giving love, or are you trying to get love?
Yeah.
That's where I believe people pleasing is manipulative. You know, you're not giving from this, you know, reciprocity where I want to, you know, two people are equally giving, you know, to the relationship. You know, one tends, you know, how would somebody know if they're a people pleaser? I think it's this word overly. You're overly accommodating. I can be accommodating, but it's the overly. And why am I being overly? You know, why am I over giving? Why am I overworking? Why am I feel like I'm working, you know, 30 times harder to make this relationship work than you are? That's that toleration. They may be okay with it, but I'm not. Like you said, there's a level there that I expect, and it's not happening. I'm trying to get you to see it.
Right. So I want to dive just a little deeper into that, because I think that this is something that comes up a lot. And I know I've talked before about my nice guy theory. I have just this theory that it's the nice guys you have to be cautious of, not the assholes, because an asshole's an asshole, and you know what they are, and you know how they're going to hurt you.
Right.
The nice guy, quote, is the one who is overly accommodating. They say all the right things. They do all the right things. And then they lash out in some really weird, passive aggressive, unhealthy way down the line. And I have had this conversation with a lot of my guy friends, and I know girls struggle with this too. There's nice girls. But what I run into is that I've heard some really frustrated nice guys who are like, well, I don't understand. Like, why can't I be nice? If I'm dating someone, I want to try to be good to them. I want to try to be accommodating. And I think there's this frustration in feeling like you're doing something because you want to help someone else. I don't think anyone wants to admit that they're doing something because they want something back. But there's also this unspoken expectation that other people think the way that you do. So can you just walk us through a little bit of what kinds of questions we could ask to really evaluate if we are people pleasing, and how we can maybe be a little more honest with ourselves of, am I really doing this because I want to do this? Or am I doing this because I am trying to accommodate or be a quote nice guy?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the harm, or the harm of people pleasing is that you think it's going to make your relationships better, but that's a lie. People don't know really what is true with the overly nice guy. Does he really want that? or is he just putting a lid on his feelings?
Yeah.
You know, questions to ask. I mean, that's the challenge is in a new relationship, especially. And now that I'm divorced and in a new phase of my life where I'm dating and so forth, I'm dealing with the same thing. I guess I just have to trust that I'm being myself and not be afraid of that rejection by me speaking up. So if I really want to know what he thinks, is that really what you want? You know, because people pleasers don't know really what they want or they think or what they feel. They're just this chameleon that's kind of melding into whatever everybody wants them to be. And that's where it's, you don't have the connection. The nice guys, you don't often feel the connection because you don't know really who they are.
1000%. I completely agree. I think it's so important to have a strong sense of self. And I think that while we might grow up with this belief that it's selfless or loving or caring just to think to the interest of other people, I think that even if you have, that definition of, love God, love others, or love others the way that you love yourself, the golden rule, if you don't love yourself well, you're not going to be able to love others well. I think that the best gift you can give the world is actually to love yourself really well and to know yourself. Because when you have a sense of self, there's a security in that. There's a consistency. You're letting people know what they're getting into. And I think a lot of the reasons, at least for me, why I feel very unsafe with nice guys, I don't date nice guys. I don't have nice friends. It's because they're a moving target. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be with someone who tells me is good with whatever I want, is good with whatever I do, because I don't know when that is going to change. I don't know when that script is going to change. And I don't know who you are.
Right.
I appreciate that you like who I am and that you want to be a part of my world, but I don't know who you're asking me to spend time with.
Right. Right. Exactly. I have this, I saw this image of, you know, what is a people pleaser? And it was all these smiley faces. And underneath it was sad, angry, happy. You know, we were taught that conflict is bad or conflict is your enemy. You know, what if we would view conflict as a friend and we would be able to lean into these conversations where this is me, you know, but somehow we feel like we have to, again, avoid looking bad. And the nice guy doesn't want to look bad. And then the whole thing that you mentioned that, you know, they just end up blowing up. Well, that was me. I would say yes, yes, yes. And that would just, you know, how is people pleasing harmful? You know, if you're not speaking your truth, you're just, it's kind of like putting a boiling pot of water on the stove and putting the lid on. It has to come out somewhere. So then you eventually just explode. And, you know, people pleasing can affect us in the workplace when we just keep getting piled on and keep, you know, being that yes person. And then we have a physical ailment or we have, you know, lash out or we, you know, exhaustion, burnout.
Yeah.
Something isn't in line. We're not in integrity with who we are. And so that's a terrible cost. And it's a reason why, you know, I chose to leave my marriage because it didn't feel true.
Right.
It wasn't in line with who I wanted, you know, the kind of relationship that I needed. No fault to him. It was just, you know, I moved the line of what I didn't move the line of what I tolerated. I had a good friend that said, you either need to accept it or change it. And I wasn't able to accept that and to be okay with that. And it was affecting my health.
Yeah. I think that our bodies and souls are incredibly honest. And I think that when we lie about things or we tell ourselves that we're fine or we tell ourselves it's not a big deal, our bodies and our souls don't accept that lie. And so it ends up coming out in weird ways like passive aggression. It comes out in resentment or annoyance. It comes out in physical illness. And it's interesting to me. I know one thing that I noticed when I started training in Krav Maga was that I didn't really have a lot of conversations with people, but I felt like I knew them really well just by watching them fight, because your body can't lie. the way that people moved, I could instantly tell that person is insecure. That person is really aggressive. That person has some rage issues. Like that person needs a therapist. That person is really calm, cool, collected. You can tell who someone is. And I think that that is such an important and underutilized skill. And especially because if, like, at least how I grew up religiously, it was, you were basically told the heart is wicked. The heart is deceitful. You can't trust yourself. Mm. And that gaslighting creates a lot of issues because you, when something comes up, you're like, well, that's, you know, that's just the devil getting in my head. Like, that's just the world getting in my head. I think it's really important. I think if we listen, our bodies and souls will tell us exactly what we are on board with. I'm curious for you, what are some ways that you listen to yourself? How have you developed that listening ability to listen to what your body and soul actually want?
Actually, after I had cancer, I had the opportunity, I was drawn to a Jesuit center talking about going out on a limb. This was one of my going out on a limb and doing something different outside of my religious community. And for 3 years, I went to a school for spiritual formation, which provided, you know, weekends of quiet. And I know we can't do weekends, but how I started listening to myself was really taking time to do this reflection. And people do that in all kinds of ways, through meditation or through a listening friend or a therapist. But I believe really in the value of writing and really just, you know, this, that stream of consciousness writing where you're just allowing yourself to say whatever you want to say. And in my book, I have some of my journal entries where it's, you know, just a place to be a witness to yourself. You know, there's a saying that says the oldest form of, well, it's not a saying, it's, I believe it's true, that one of the oldest forms of healing is listening. And it just requires somebody to listen. And so when we write, we are giving ourselves an opportunity to listen to ourselves. And I was at recently at a networking event, and we had to share a time that we felt really heard or listened to in the recent past. And people could not think of a time that they were really listened to. And writing and journaling, or however you want to describe it, or if it's on your phone, where you're just allowing yourself to say what's on your soul. It's kind of like you're eavesdropping on your soul. It's like, you know, what am I hearing? And again, like you said, we're taught that, you know, the enemy comes in there, or we can't trust our heart. And that's actually one of the steps, is dropping into your heart. Like, you can be trusted. What doesn't feel good doesn't feel good for you. It may not feel good to somebody else, but it's how you feel. And so it's part of my journey was too, also just trusting that what came out onto the paper was me. It was what I thought, what I believed, what I know to be true for me in that moment. And that was huge for me, because I didn't have a lot of places in my life to be able to express that. So for me, on paper was where it started, and having time and space.
Yeah. I think that's a really powerful exercise. And I love that phrase, eavesdropping on the soul. And for me, I love writing, but I tend to write in a self-edited sort of way. I write for public consumption. And I think a lot of that actually has to do with growing up. My mom had sort of an inappropriate nosiness about my life. And so she would read my diaries, and then I would get in trouble for things that I wrote. And so I have this permanent anxiety that anything I write down is public information. But I do similar. I verbal processing. I'm such a verbal processor. And whether it's talking to a therapist, sometimes it's having conversations on this podcast. But I think it's been interesting, because sometimes I will hit the record button as I'm talking things out with a friend or with a therapist or whoever, and I can delete it when I'm done, but I will listen back to it. And it's almost like if you just keep talking, if you don't shut yourself down and you keep going, you find yourself saying things where you're like, huh, I didn't know that was in there. Like, maybe we should unpack that suitcase. I had missed that one hiding in the corner. So I think that that is a really important part too, of really just emptying things out and finding the stuff that maybe is covered in dust that we sort of forgot about, that maybe needs to be unpacked a little bit.
I'm going to give a shout out to an app that my two friends and I have been doing for the last couple of years. It's called Marco Polo. Have you heard of it?
I have not.
It's basically a, well, it's not basically, but it's an app where one of you speaks and then the other one at any time can watch it back. So it's just, you get to just go on and record this video. And then you get this email that says, oh, so-and-so left you a Marco Polo message. And then they respond. But it has just been so healing because you can just speak to another person without any interruption, without any comments. And you have this person that's witnessing. It is very powerful. And you know, again, it's been part of, you know, part of my journey of having another person witness my soul and my truth without having that person's immediate feedback and immediate response and their facial expressions and their whatever, you know, it's just a really powerful, powerful tool that has been helpful.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'll definitely have to check that out. I think there's something to be said for the completion of something, definitely. And I sort of the visual that I have in my head is like trying to organize a house. And a lot of times when we're having conversation, I feel like someone says something and it makes the other person think of something. So then they chime in and you were going one way with a really deep, profound thought, but then they said this. So then you jump on that train and then you jump on that train. Yes. And it's almost like trying to organize your house and spending a minute in the kitchen and a minute in the bathroom and a minute in the bedroom. You're never actually going to finish a room.
Yes. Yes. It's so very well said. I think
there's something to that of being uninterrupted and actually seeing where a thought ends up.
Yeah. And allowing yourself to feel something, you know, with a close friend, you know, it's not your therapist who's trying to analyze you, you know? And what I've enjoyed, I actually got the pro account or whatever. And I can go back and I'm like, I'm a pretty damn wise woman, you know, like I'm saying, that might be a book with all those Marco Polos back there. No, but it's actually a nice place to be able to process with another person without, you know, it's kind of that eavesdropping on the soul that I mentioned with the writing.
Yeah. Well, and that's a big piece of overcoming people pleasing too, I think, is realizing that you are as awesome as anyone else. That's a cool feeling, you know, like I grew up feeling like everyone else in the world was somehow smarter or more capable than I was. And then I got into my 30s and, you know, started doing more speaking and business and just, you know, kind of went through my belated quarter life crisis. And I'll read things back or listen to things, be like, huh, that's really inspiring.
Yes.
And it feels arrogant to say it out loud because of how we grow up, I think, and the things that we're told. But honestly, if you are not living a life that can inspire yourself, what life are you living?
Right. Well, I think that's partly why I say in the chapter on writing, write your way to wellness is, you know, just what you're speaking to, you know, make a life worth recording, you know, make a life that you want to write about. And, you know, it's not all, you know, being human is a place to let your humanity out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the process of overcoming people pleasing is probably a lifelong journey. I think there's always things to be working on, but I know that there's big chunks that I think are really helpful in getting started in that. And in your book, you share 12 of them, 12 key steps to overcoming people pleasing. How did you come up with those 12 steps? How did you look through your life and think these are the 12 that had the biggest impact on getting me to where I am today?
Yeah, I think looking back over my life, I think the first two steps are definitely ones that I started 20 years ago. The more recent, the end of the 12 were the ones that I'm you know, have been working on the last couple of years. You know, the 12 steps came from the recovery movement. As a recovering people pleaser, I wanted to kind of piggyback on the 12 steps. I really wanted to have a balance between some practical steps, one being the play, making play a priority, and then the one on dropping into our heart, that kind of mindfulness of, you know, who do I want to become, and really taking action on how we want to feel, for example. So, yeah, I just, you know, I can't say that I, they came very naturally to me.
Yeah.
It's just, it's, I think the 12 were what has, I have found to be the most helpful and the most, you know, help that I could give that would help the most people.
Yeah. They're all great. The stories are just so relatable. And I think that those processes are all just really profound things that would help anyone to work through. What are some indicators or questions that we could ask to determine you might be a people pleaser? If, what are some of those signs?
I mentioned the thing about lying, just when you're aware that you want to say no and you said yes, or you're telling people what they want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely a big one. I think for me, that was one, was the dishonesty, but then also for me, a big one was passivity and not having an opinion and realizing that I didn't really have a lot of opinions. Like if it was a group of friends, where do you want to eat? I don't care, wherever you want to eat.
Right.
What movie do you want to watch? Yes. I don't know, whatever movie you want to watch.
Yeah.
So I think having that strong sense of self and not just being honest about what exists, but finding more things to be honest about. And so for me, I guess kind of going back to your idea of playing, curiosity was really big for me, giving myself permission to try things and to realize like, all right, like I kind of like this. You know what? I like being in the dojo and beating people up. Who knew? Never would have thought it was something that I enjoy, but here I am 4 times a week, jumping on top of people and choking them and punching them. There's other things that, you know, you think you would like that you don't. I thought that I would like having a beer and hanging out with the guys. I don't. I think beer is disgusting, but I've tried it and now I know. So
love it.
I think that curiosity is really important. What would you tell someone who realizes they're a people pleaser? What is the one place that they should start to begin to work through that?
Oh, I have so many thoughts running through my head. One of the, just to kind of piggyback on the curiosity, I kind of tell people to be like a person at the beach with a metal detector. You know, where in your life do you feel these kind of beeps of joy that you allow yourself to feel that curiosity, or that you get a little bit of excitement when you discover something? So that, you know, definitely play. I think where to start, I would definitely start with the shooting on ourselves. There's so much shooting. I should do this. And most of the time there's a should because there's some kind of guilt that we feel about something. So I would just become this super hyper vigilant observer of your life and notice where you should do something and just be mindful of the choice that you have in that moment and to feel like you have choice. And I like what I like about my book. There is some, you know, you talked about this passivity. There's some practical tools in there to have, you know, the conversations that maybe you're avoiding, or, you know, making play a priority was huge for me because I had 4 kids and I felt like I had to be on call all the time. It was like, no, I'm going to this women's group and we're going out afterwards, you know, and I started to have, you know, scheduled play dates for myself. My kids had all these play dates. I started to make a point of having a play date with my former spouse and with my girlfriends once a week, because that was what was going to help me to practice some of these things outside of my normal circle of people.
Yeah. Well, and I think kind of along the same lines, that was something for me, was realizing how many times I said I need to be. And it almost felt like the world was going to stop spinning if I didn't show up. And if you're in a position where you feel like the world is going to stop spinning if you don't show up, you need a different world.
Right.
You need different people. And I talk to a lot of people who struggle with that. And they'll say, well, I have to do this. Like, I need to do this. I have to be there for my kids. I have to do all the soccer practices and all of the PTA stuff. And I have to do this for my husband. I have to do this for work. It's work.
Right.
And I think that is a really important thing of realizing, first of all, many of the things that we think we need to do, I don't think we need to do. Right. Like the world's not going to stop spinning.
What makes us need to do that? What I always like the what question. What makes us need to do that?
What is the consequence? And if it's something like, you know, the consequence is that the dishes are going to sit in my sink for a day, the world is not going to stop spinning if a dish stays in my sink for a day so that I can go out and have fun or do something or rest. So I think that that's really important to think about the consequences and to, like you said, be aware and check in with ourselves. And if we feel like there's no space in our life where we have that joy and we can say, I'm doing this for me, I'm doing this because I enjoy it. If our entire life is obligation, time to get a new life.
Yeah. That's where the resentment comes in, right? Another characteristic of a people pleaser. I never get to do what I want, you know, oh, everybody's having fun and I'm not, you know, and like you said, I need to do this. It just becomes, it becomes joyless.
Yeah. And I think that it's tough because I think that we really do believe that we don't have permission. And I think it's very difficult to take that personal responsibility. I mean, for myself, I think for a lot of people, there's anger of like, what do you mean personal responsibility? Like you're telling me that it's my fault that I can't go have fun. You think I don't want to go have fun? But it is, if we're not changing something, if we're not actively working to change something, we've chosen it.
Right.
And I think that's a very difficult reality to swallow. How do you work through that? How do you take personal responsibility and being able to say, I'm going to create this life of play, even though there's responsibilities, there's kids, there's work, there's bills, there's all these things. And it's not that you're neglecting them, but how do you prioritize yourself in a way where you really are taking that ownership in your life?
I think as people pleasers, we're constantly, as I say, checking the weather. And I think you might've spoken to this. We're always gauging, you know, we're assessing the conditions. And so we're always kind of reacting. And so responsibility to me, I kind of broke it down with the, I heard it once said, it's respondability. Responsibility is your ability to respond. And so, you know, overcoming and changing or overcoming people pleasing is about change, but it's also about choosing. It's more of about choosing. And yeah, this takes small steps over long periods of time to change these ingrained habits. One choice I made through all that was I decided I wasn't going to do the laundry of my four kids and they started doing their laundry. I mean, some moms would say I need to do it. Well, anyway, that's beside the point. Taking responsibility and making those choices that say, this doesn't work for me. You know, this doesn't work for me. I need support. Can you help me? You know, again, I'm responsible for my life. And that has to do with how I respond, my ability to respond to what is coming at me. And so to change that or to overcome that, I have to choose differently. I have to respond differently.
Yeah, I think that's huge. Just even replacing that language from I need to do this to I choose to do this. And see how that tastes for a while. I choose to do everybody's laundry, even though they're capable of doing it themselves. I choose to not have a life and to always accommodate other people. And sometimes just changing the language, it makes you hear things differently. And I think gives us a different lens to see what's really going on in our life.
I know I said to my son at one point, I was like, you have a really good life. And I went on, you know, it was in those moments where I had stuffed everything, became resentful. And he's like, I never asked you to do all that. I was like, you're right. They don't ask us to do all that. They just, we've taught them, you know, that saying, we teach people how to treat us. I've taught them that this is what I'm going to do for them, you know, and, you know, relationships are about negotiating, you know, healthy relationships are about negotiating. And then we get into these over-accommodating, over-giving, overworking, and it's not a mutual relationship.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's where a lot of those conversations are needed, especially if you're cohabitating with someone. And I know I had those conversations growing up where I remember asking my mom to stop doing my laundry because it was getting thrown back in my face every time she wanted something. If like, well, like I did all your laundry last week. I'm like, I did not ask you to. And in fact, I am formally requesting that you cease doing laundry. And it's also realizing a lot of times, taking ownership over realizing this bugs me and it's okay that it doesn't bug someone else. Like it might bug if you have a roommate situation, you know, people have different levels of cleanliness. Maybe you're type A and it really bugs you to have a messy home. Mm-hmm. Maybe your roommate doesn't care, doesn't bug them at all. You can't be resentful of someone because they're not bugged by the same things you're bugged by. You have to have a conversation. You have to bring it up and say, hey, seems that you like living this way. I like living this way. Right. We both have to cohabitate. So we can either choose, do we move to different places or do we find a compromise?
Exactly.
And I think that a lot of times that's a really big thing with people pleasing is that we are mad at people without ever telling them why we're mad at them.
Right.
Which is very unfair because if you don't tell someone why you're mad at them, they're not a mind reader. And I think that's a good question to ask. Am I expecting this person to be inside my head?
Well, I liked what you said earlier about opinions because Matthew Kelly in his book, Seven Levels of Intimacy, talks about the third level as opinions. It's facts, first it's cliches, and then it's facts, and then it's opinions. And he talks about intimacy as into me see. And intimacy is into me see. And I can't develop intimacy with you, as we said before, with Mr. Nice Guy, if I'm not allowing them to see me. And so it really is having the confidence and the courage, and which I believe would be really helpful to do this book in a group, because we need people to help us muster that courage and the confidence to lean into those conversations, because they're not for the faint of heart.
No, they're not. And I think even just having that outside perspective, for good and bad, I need other people who can call me out on things and say, hey, Sarah, you're a little much in these areas. But I also need people when I am hard on myself to be like, you know, Sarah, you're really awesome at these things.
Yeah.
I think we need that. I think we need that outside lens. And it's about, I think people pleasing, like we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, it's not about going to the other extreme of, well, I don't need anyone's approval. I'm going to do my own thing. I think it's still very important to value other people's opinions, to get outside opinion, criticism, thought, but to maintain ownership. You're still having the same conversations. You're still hearing the same opinions. You're still having the interactions, but you are not in control of my life and my narrative. I am. And it's really just changing that ownership hat.
And I think most of the people pleasing happens because, as you said, we're trying to manage our own anxiety about a situation.
Yeah.
We don't want to feel the discomfort of leaning into that conversation. So I'm just going to do it because I need to do it because I can't deal with this anxiety that I have if I don't do it.
Right.
So it's that, it's really that, you know, dropping in the heart and really just, you know, being in your body and saying, you know, in this moment, this is how I'm going to respond next. And it's not getting overwhelmed with thinking, you know, if I do this thing for them the rest of their life, it's going to be this way. You're just trying to take that small little tweak to change something to see what happens. That's really challenging to do.
Yeah.
You have support around you. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. We could talk about this all day. There's so much to unpack. We both have, I know everyone has so many stories of people pleasing. If you are a people pleaser, know that you're not alone. This is a universal affliction, but it is curable. highly recommend the book. There's a lot of really helpful tips. 12 Steps to Overcoming People Pleasing by Trina Setzman. Trina, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom. It's a joy as always to talk to you. For anyone listening, I would love to hear your thoughts, struggles, funny stories. Shoot us an email at embracetheish@gmail.com or hang out with us online at successfulish.com or Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn at embracetheish.
Success and failure, none of opposite ends. Curveball hits, gotta know where to bend. The attitude will affect destination. and if you determine when you're going to make it. Live Between Successes makes life rich. Live in every moment. Successful-ish. Live Between Successes makes life rich. Live in every moment. Successful-ish. Hey,
successful-ish.
Another day, another task. Think fast with a whole nother mission complete.
I'm successful-ish.
Pick up the weight, press on, and act on the visions I see.
I'm successful-ish.
Sit back and bask in the glory of all the goals I achieve.
Successful-ish.
Lose a stack, get it back, reinvest, hope with, then I roll up my sleeve.
I'm successful-ish.
Another day, another task. Think fast with a whole nother mission complete.
Successful-ish.
Pick up the weight, press on, and act on the visions I see.
I'm successful-ish.
Sit back and bask in the glory of all the goals I achieve.
Successful-ish.
Lose a stack, get it back, reinvest, hope with, then I roll up my sleeve.
Hey. All this weight on my arms, need both flex. In this race, but behind, need more steps. Had to swear the learning curve, hope I don't crash. Hit your nerves when reserves got low cash. When I fail, realize that it won't last. You made it through in the past, just look back. Successful-ish, you can see how the contrast failures and wins. Use the past and then bounce back.
You can never win if you never go and do it. Failure is a hard road, rarely ever cruising. Embracing all my wins with a handful of losing. Expect the drought season when the plan's going fluent. I can never really fail, it's all how you view it. It's all a lesson, just depends how you use it. Gather all the data and keep it all exclusive. Never ending journey and the growth is therapeutic. My identity is not in what you see, I am the better me. Mistakes others make, I see.
Have been teaching me.
Compare yourself to others is an insult to tragedy.
We will make unique, gotta use again collectively.
Broke down my goals and a few look toesome.
Can't take them back cause you already spoke them.
Easily regress if you don't stay focused. Focus, live between success every moment.
Successful-ish.
Another day, another task. Think fast with a whole nother mission complete.
I'm successful-ish.
Pick up the weight, press on, and act on the visions I see.
I'm successful-ish.
Sit back and bask in the glory of all the goals I achieve.
Successful-ish.
Lose a stack, get it back, reinvest, hope with, then I roll up my sleeve.
I'm successful-ish.
Another day, another task. Think fast with a whole nother mission complete.
Successful-ish.
Pick up the weight, press on, and act on the visions I see.
I'm successful-ish.
Sit back and bask in the glory of all the goals I achieve.
Successful-ish.
Lose a stack, get it back, reinvest, hope with, then I roll up my sleeve.